Welcome to today's episode. Today, I'm joined by Caroline Humer. And Caroline Humer is a digital safety and child protection expert globally in terms of the work that you've done. Caroline, I know that makes you sound absolutely like you're in every corner of the planet, but one of the things I wanted to say is right at the outset here, I met you a couple of years ago in terms of the trust and safety space where you put together a forum. We will have a conversation about that separately. And for now, we're going to start with why you do what you do, but could we have a little bit of how you got to be where you are? And then we will talk about your podcast around missing people.
Sure. And thank you for having me. The simplest version, I guess, is I studied business studies at university in the UK. Didn't know what to do afterwards. Got a job for 2.5 years with the British Transport Police investigating train crash. That was early in the early 2000s when we had Paddington and Hatfield crash, and there was a third one. And so that was what got me into the police work. And after 2.5 years of train crash investigations, that sort of came to an end, and I moved to the US to then pursue a career in child protection. That's how I really fell into it. I then worked with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children for the last 18 years. Within those 18 years, I did 2.5, 3 years of analyzing child sexual abuse material, identifying where the material was coming from and where it was created, to then coordinate with the police on the arrests or creating more intelligence information, what is happening within that. And then the last couple of years with the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children, I was responsible and ran and created the largest missing children's program focusing on 32 countries across the world, coordinating expertise and knowledge around missing children issues, building child rescue alert programs, or as in the US, we call them Amber Alert programs, in 19 countries around the world, and working essentially with prosecutors, police, attorney generals, policymakers, charities to essentially build a framework around how we deal with missing children, because there wasn't anything, or very little, to say the least.
So, I mean, there we are, 32 countries and then 19 other countries. So when I did say, you know, global, I meant it. There's something about the space that we're in at the moment in terms of us, and I'm just thinking for the people that will be listening to this, so, you know, practitioners, workers, we are in a space and time where technology enables a lot of things, which you've talked about there in terms of working at, and I'm going to use the acronyms NCMEC and IGMEC, that there is this element of missing people. Now, what I am going to set the stage with is actually you have a podcast yourself called Missing Persons Uncovered, which really we're going to be signposting people towards that today from this conversation. Now, that phrase missing is really interesting, isn't it? It's often used in the United Kingdom for training people around child sexual exploitation. But this is what I really wanted to get into the weeds with you with. In terms of what do we mean by missing people, or in this circumstance, as you were just alluding to, missing children? What do we mean by that? Or what do you mean by that?
And that is always sort of the biggest question, right? How can we tackle something if we don't understand it, or if we don't have a definition? And this is part of the issues and the challenge that tackling the missing aspect of protection around the world is that we don't have a universal definition. Missing is described in so many different ways depending on the circumstances, the cultural aspects, economic aspects, anything that's surrounding you. And therefore, there is no definition. But in general, we say a missing person is anyone that we don't know where they are.
Yeah.
So that could mean essentially they've you don't know where they are for 10 minutes, or you don't know where they are for 20 years.
Right. Yeah.
There is that, and that's where sort of that's the main definition. We of course then categorize the different types of missing, from abductions to runaway, which we don't like the term runaway because it's misconstrued, but we haven't figured out a better term for it. There are definitions of lost, injured, or otherwise missing. There's definitions for missing unaccompanied children, so refugees. There's also forced disappearances. So there are so many categorizing aspects to it. The other one that most people don't think about is missing at war.
That was just going through my head in terms of the conflict right now.
Considering the two conflicts that we've currently got going on, there's a lot of people that are missing due to war. And that's not just the civilians, but also the soldiers.
Yep.
So we've got people missing from war as civilians, and we've got people missing from war as soldiers, as individuals who are fighting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we even have an acronym for that. Good to put your teeth in, Kath. An acronym. We have that missing in action, don't we, MIA, for soldiers. But we don't have, we don't have these phrases, I suppose, for the people. I mean, at the moment, I think the internet is showing us plenty of material about people who go missing and just how difficult that is.
And I think the hard part is that when we talk about missing, we don't understand what that means. We still don't understand what it means. It's an individual thing.
Yeah.
And that's when we say the definition of anybody whose whereabouts are unknown. Well, to whom? Is that to the police? Is that to the individuals that looking for the person? Or is it the person that is actually missing? Because a lot of time research has actually shown us that the person that is missing doesn't consider themselves as missing. So who categorized the person as missing? Is it the police or the person that's looking for the person?
Mm-hmm.
That makes it really, really difficult in that aspect of saying, well, we read missing, the verb or the word itself is used in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
We glance over it because it's just like, oh yeah, okay, we know what we're talking about, it we know it, but we actually don't understand it.
Well, I mean, it is a term that you got used a lot in my work, going in and supporting people in residential settings. They say, oh, that, yeah, this child has a habit it's a habit in air quotes of going missing.
Mm-hmm.
Or they are at risk of going missing. So it was used in kind of two different ways, even in there. The more you're talking, the more I'm thinking, how many spaces have I been in where I don't even understand what people are talking about? So that's wow.
Sorry. Yeah. Right. And you know, specifically for the UK audience, just to give them sort of a reference, the UK has changed their definition on missing at least, I would say, probably 3 to 5 times in the last 10 years.
Helpful.
So how can you then know what that actually means from the public side or as a professional, because it changes? And I'm not saying I don't mean that in a bad way, because what the UK has done is trying to keep up in understanding what does that mean. And the UK has done the most research, the most up-to-date on this issue of missing compared to other countries?
Well, that was what that was where my head was going. So if we don't have a definition and we haven't got an accurate way of looking at it or researching it, how do we look at the numbers? So I know that obviously we've spoken about this. The numbers that you talked about on the podcast when you first began that, which you were doing, I think, at the end of lockdown, weren't you? It was, or maybe still in lockdown, I don't know.
essentially, we started 2 years ago, where we just finished the last episode of season two.
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of where we'll probably end up to kind of navigating towards today, yeah, in terms of the child sexual exploitation. But what kind of numbers do we have? And are those numbers of people that have reported it or people that have been found, which must be the antithesis or opposite? I'm not sure how you want to answer this.
Well, the way we look at it is that, one, because we don't have a common definition across countries, we can't compare the numbers, or it's very difficult to compare the numbers. So what we did, with the help of my co-host, Karen Chaloff Green, who's a professor at University of Portsmouth, is we extrapolated and said, we have a few numbers, and if we extrapolate these numbers, we are estimating that there's about 8 million people that are reported missing globally, right? But that's just reported. So that's a very small number, because we know a lot of people aren't reported missing, either because the people who are looking for the missing person are scared of the police, or they're ashamed to go to the police.
Yeah.
Or the person that is missing actually comes back before you report.
Yeah.
So at that point, so you have a dark figure of missing that we don't know how big that is. So our assumption is that it is way bigger than 8 million that go missing on an annual basis.
And also, if you don't have a system that you can, I'm just thinking about, like, for example, the war at the moment, if you don't have a system to report to, or after whether there's been something like an earthquake, that's going to make it even harder to get those figures. So in terms
of... It is. And there are structures in place with people from Missing from War, and we did an episode on Missing from War in the second season, also with a UK expert from Portsmouth University, and he was on the episode. He essentially explains how there is an infrastructure put in place with the International Red Cross, as well as the war, or the two countries that are at war, multiple countries that are at war, how they keep track of who's missing and who isn't. And so we have the soldiers usually have dog tags. I think that's what we call them in English in any way. And those dog, if you are in the enemy territory and you see and you have soldiers that are missing with dog tags, you actually take those dog tags with you so that they are then registered as missing or as deceased, so the other country can notify. So there is a quo in a way that's in there between countries. Is it working perfectly? Absolutely not. But we are trying as humans to put something in place to help with it. And that's the same with general, I'm putting quotations on it, as today's missing, as general missing, as being not from war, but, or not abductions, but current missing, as in I walk out the door today and I disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That could be, as I said, I don't like the word runaway, but it could be a runaway. It could be because you're an elderly person who has dementia or Alzheimer's. Right. So there are those are the missing today that law enforcement and the police tackle every single day.
Yep. Yeah, I know that we and it's almost, I don't know whether the word's cruel, but I find it really interesting how with the older generation, we tend to strap them with things on their ankles or in their coats and put these kind of detect a little bit like you would with a dog, you know, that runs off.
Yeah.
Lots of my friends have this for their dogs that are, you know, pretty much fast runaways. But we're doing that to some people because they have possibly less less ability to consent in terms of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm just thinking, because I tend to focus around the children on this podcast in terms of online safety and things like that. If we look at if a young person goes missing, so a young person or a child, what I'm just thinking whether we do reasons, what happens with reporting, what I know I'd said I was going to ask you a load of questions and I had them in my head, but they're shifting at the moment. So I'm wondering if people might want to know actually what happens when somebody goes missing and they make a report. What's the process? What
So,
usually happens?
yeah, so my biggest tip and the biggest pet peeve that I have is if you know of somebody that's missing or you're worried that somebody is missing, report it immediately. Do not wait 24 hours or 48 hours. There is no law in the UK, US, Canada, and a lot of other countries that state you have to wait. And if you go to a police station and they say we have to wait, you can say that is incorrect because the law states you have to take the report and start investigating immediately. So the biggest thing, because I say this is because the time is of essence.
Yes.
The quicker we look for a person, the more likely the person is found safely and in good condition. Right?
Well, yeah, because that's about time and geography, isn't it?
And exactly. And especially in today's world, especially with young people, they have ways to get around very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's no longer, oh, did they have a credit card? They don't need a credit card. They just need to have the card stored on their phone or on their watches and be able to tap it wherever they need to go.
Yeah.
So it is that easy for them to go from county to county or city to city, and then you've got different jurisdictions, right?
Yeah.
So the quicker we look for them, the more likely it is we can find them. And the good news is also that the young people and children who go missing usually stick to the areas that they know, so they don't usually go too far.
Mm-hmm.
Because their environment isn't as big as a country or as more than one city, depending, right? But we look at that area. So the first thing to do is make that report. How do you make the report? Is try to get as much information as possible to the police.
Mm-hmm.
The police should take everything or they need to take everything. You want to give them as much detail as possible of what the person was wearing when you last saw them, when the last time you were in contact with them, what kind of information do they have online, what kind of phone are they using, what social media platforms are they on, especially with young kids.
Yeah.
Has any of their behaviors changed recently? These are questions that the police will ask. So don't be intimidated by the questions the police are asking, because they're only asking to understand the individual that is missing to be able to help find the person. So it may be a little personal, but try to understand that they're not trying to judge you for what is happening, but really trying to get the information to be able to help you find the person and the child or the young person.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a difficult situation because you feel you're being attacked by an individual saying, but why didn't, you know, when was the last time you talked? Oh, why didn't, how come you didn't talk to them for the last 24 hours? No, That's our regular system. It's okay to those are, the police are not trying to attack you. They're trying to answer and get information and insight over the person that is missing.
Yeah, which actually I think is the way that I'd structured this in my head in terms of the questions. So the reasons why young people go missing, usually the questions that are being asked are about finding out, for example, their behaviour changed, they got a new phone, they came in with some brand new clothes on and off they went, and now I don't know where they are. Mm-hmm. That could actually be really important for the police, because they could put things together and go, okay, this sounds like, for example, sextortion, county lines, as we now call it, et cetera, yep. Organised crime, whatever.
Yep.
But I suspect, as the person making the report feeling scared, you're going to feel that they're asking inappropriate, intrusive type questions. But yes, what you're saying is they're not.
Because, and that's why I think a lot of people are scared to go to the police, because they're ashamed, because they think it's their fault the person ran away or is missing. And it doesn't have, it's not the case. They want to get the information. The way I look at it is, you go into a police station and you're essentially handing a police officer a 1,000 piece puzzle piece and say, solve it. You've got 10 minutes to solve this, but I won't tell you what that picture looks like. Yeah. It doesn't work. The more you give the police officer, the more likelihood they can actually solve the puzzle quicker. And for me, it's the more puzzle pieces you give them to understand what that person that's missing is like, what has changed, if anything has changed, the more likely they can actually create the puzzle, which is the picture of the person, to understand, oh, okay, they don't like water, so they're not going to go towards water or towards the river or towards the sea. Oh, they like playgrounds? Oh, let me see if we've had any fairs going on, that maybe that's where they went.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Those kind of things is important. And that's why it's important to give the police as much information as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And not be scared of the question, or not be intimidated, but scared of the questions, or feel like they're attacking you as a parent or as a guardian for what is happening.
Yeah, I think what you said about being ashamed, certainly in terms of the young people I work with, and a little story that one of my friends told about her 7-year-old son that packed his suitcase and had said, I don't like it in this house anymore. I'm going to go and live with my granddad, and off they set. Now, 7-year-olds don't usually go that far, because they get halfway up the street and they're like, I don't know where I'm going. But certainly with young people, this is that space of adolescent discord, isn't it? This is the space where it was likely a disagreement. That's a gentle term. I'm going to say it was a full-on row. There's usually an explosive part of, I said this, they said that, then I said this, and it culminated in maybe the young person leaving at that point. And if we think about that kind of exploitation, it might be because the child is ashamed and scared of what the other person might do. So we're starting to get into that kind of complexity of, why do you think young people go missing? What have you found in research? What are the reasons? But they're not going to be concrete, obviously.
Yeah, I think it can be anything. It's an individual thing, right? And this is why it's important for the police that are trying to help to understand the person that is missing, because it's about the character. It's about how the person that is missing is feeling, or what has happened. So in research, we have seen, or we use the term pull and push factors.
Yeah.
And those are the two reasons why people go missing, and young people especially, is either they're being pulled away from the home because they want to explore the world, they want to have adventure, if that is involved in drugs, or if that's in, I want to go to a big city and be a model, or I just want to go and see my best friend who's now moved away, could be the reason for going missing, right? It's sort of being pulled into a different way. And then you've got, of course, the push factors that maybe something's happening in the house where the young person is living. That could be alcoholism, that could be abuse, but it could also be death. It could be that the young person or the family just encountered a family death, a family disease, you know, just died of their grandmother, grandfather. And the young person doesn't know what to do with the feelings. And they just feel like nobody understands me. And so nobody gets me. Nobody understands me. I'm going away. Mm-hmm. And so they run away. Again, I don't like the term, but they leave the house and go somewhere where they feel they're more heard, or they are have a better way of communicating with their emotions. So there are these factors that, and I don't want to call them benign, but they're not the usual factors that we think of. Alcoholism, abuse, violence, assaults are sort of the big things that we think of immediately of, oh, that's why they went missing.
Well, certainly I've worked with young people who use what I call a screw you approach, which is I'm going to go missing because then you're going to worry and then I will know if you care or not.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why it's important that we understand the individual. We try to understand the person that is missing, of saying what is it that the person, what is it that made the person leave? What is it that they're looking for, right? And that then also, of course, comes into that once you do find the young person and they return, how do you talk to them afterwards to ensure that they don't run away again or they disappear again? Because a lot of times you bring them, the police find them, they bring them home and they go again, screw you, I'm going back out because my friends are in a different town, or I'm having more fun over here because no one's telling me not to drink alcohol, or and no one's giving me a curfew, or no one's telling me I can't say this word, etc. So the important part is not only finding the person, but is then talking to the person once they're found to determine explain to me what happened while you were away, what made you leave the house, what is it, what, how can we change that so we ensure that you stay in a safe place that is consistent and not go, you know, you don't leave the house every 2-3 weeks or every week for 2 days and then come back and sleep on the street. So the great thing is the UK has a program that works, and police work with the charity Missing People, and so they help in providing services, dedicated services with essentially counselors that are not police officers, to talk to these young people after they've been found, to say, what's going on? How can we help? And that's important.
Yes, I would certainly say the older adolescents are well aware that they don't have to go back home. So there's also, you know, the knowledge of young people as well, being aware that if they do leave, they don't necessarily have to be taken home by the police. My head started fizz buzzing a minute ago, Caroline, in terms of, so what I'll say is, in my first book, I actually talk about social media and adoptive parents in terms of images that get shared, because a lot of the children I was working with in adoption cases were being found by family members who were saying, oh, my child has gone missing, or here's a picture of my child. So I was actually critiquing the sharing of images by services that weren't, for example, the police. So what's your what does research say? What's your opinion or your thinking in terms of your work in this area? What do you think about that idea of images being shared on social media by police? And obviously I'm sitting there going, maybe actually I shouldn't have said what I said in terms of around the adoption thing. But I know certainly with the adoptive children that I was working with, that was one of the, let's call it negative symptoms of people creating missing type posts.
Yeah, I think you should go, one, it should go through official channels. If you're going, if somebody is missing, use the police, use Missing People Charity in the UK or NetMec in the US or other charities that are out there to be able to create those posters. The posters are vital because law enforcement, the police, do not have the capacity to look for every single person 24/7.
Yeah.
So as I, if you look, if you think about the numbers, right, as we said, you've got 8 million around the world. If we just concentrate, let's say if we just concentrate on the US, as I know those numbers sort of more than the UK, but the US has about just over, I think, 400,000 children go missing under the age of 18 on a yearly basis. That's close to, I think, if my math is right, 2,000 a day. Right? And you do, and the US is big. So yes, certain jurisdictions may not have a missing person, a missing child that day. But 2,000 a day, you cannot look for every single child by yourself. You do need the public to help. And you need eyes to be able to create tips, intelligence to know where they are. And not every child gets a poster. That's for one, that's another thing, right? So just because you go missing doesn't mean that you end up on a poster.
Yeah.
That's one thing. If you do end up on a poster, then the distribution of those posters are dedicated to certain particular areas where we hope through either the intelligence gathered by the police or the charity to know in this neighborhood, I will hopefully get more impact of finding this child than sending it over to this city or this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's targeted distribution. That's possible, at least on, if we're talking about physical distribution. If we're talking about social media, I think again it has to go through through official channels.
Yeah.
And the official channels have to make it clear also that once the child is found, that they take the information back off. Or they and top of that also include saying we have found the person or the young person, we no longer need your help to look for them, right? Make it as reasonable as possible to remove the information on social media. We know once you post it's always going to be online, but there are technology methods that allow you to limit the distribution so that you can remove it safely. On top of that, in Europe, and the UK is not in the EU, but you do have the right to be forgotten law that allows you to contact social media to say, please remove my information, right?
Uh-huh.
As a missing person that then has returned, you have the ability to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was the swear word that we're going to keep out of this today, called the GDPR. But I'm just thinking, actually, the mechanisms that you were talking about then in the distribution of images, removal of images, well, actually, that's moving towards the conversation that we were getting to anyway, in terms of child sexual exploitation and sometimes what that's associated with, which is obviously CSAM, which for people who are joining this episode and haven't ever listened to another one, that's the acronym for Child Sexual Abuse Material. So both you and I obviously have a lot of conversations within these areas, but how is going missing related to or correlated with CSE, CSAM, exploitation, sextortion, all of the other stuff.
All the different terminologies that we I think it's very simple. So we go back to the scenario of pull and push factors. Every child, or I think most children in today's world, are online, either through their phone, iPad, laptop, gaming console, you name it. They're playing games, they're talking to their friends, etc. It could be that they then talk to an individual that is only their virtual friend and not a real life friend that they've actually met in person. So they know them only through the cyberspace, so to speak. If that is gaming, if that's through social media, through any platforms. They start chatting. It can't, and that goes then into that we share images. We say, oh, how do you look like? What were you wearing today? Oh, let me look. And you start sharing images of yourself and you take a selfie of yourself and share that with that individual. And it goes on and on and on. And in the end, you may actually be sharing nude images of yourself as teenagers, as young person, or as an adult. Adults do it too.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's sort of considered as sexting, right? So it becomes from a selfie into sexting. Once you share it as a sexting picture, nude images, what has now transpired since the lockdown with COVID and everything, that it's exploded into sextortion.
Yes.
Which essentially is that you've taken a selfie, a nude image or a sexual image of yourself. You've shared it with an intimate partner. You've shared it with a friend online, or boyfriend, girlfriend, you name it. And they then turn on you and say, well, now that you've shared this nude intimate image of yourself, I want £500. Otherwise, I will share this with your family or your parents or your school mates. And everybody will know that you are, that you've shared a nude image. So we've got that life. If you say, maybe it's not a lifespan, but you start with a selfie, we then go into sort of sexting, and it then turns into a criminal act of sextortion, where they extort you either for money. It doesn't always have to be for money, but majority time it's for money, or for also for more photos.
Yeah.
And videos.
Yeah. Yep.
And what then also happens is that the individual that you're sending those information, that these images and videos to, may actually distribute them onto a dedicated website for pornography.
Well, that's let's make that very clear. I know I did a podcast episode, I think it might have been season one or season two. Over 18 is revenge porn, as it is often called, and under 18 is child sexual abuse imagery. So if these young people, because let's just talk about those that are under 18, are sharing these images, that's it's such a big factor in terms of not telling anybody. And I am going to be doing an episode with somebody around county lines and some of the organised crime that goes on in this particular space. But you can, and I'm sure that listeners can already kind of piece together why somebody might now go missing, because of this background history, which actually, when they do go missing, would a parent or residential centre, would they know this?
I think it's hard, because you probably, and the residential homes don't have all the resources. Right? There's not enough manpower compared to the young people that are actually in the residential homes. Yes. So you've probably, and I don't know what the ratio is, but if you've got one adult that's taking care of 10 young children or young persons, they can't monitor everything that's going on online.
Yeah. And often they don't
even
have
as an individual parent, right? As an individual parent, you can't pay attention to everything that your two children or one child is doing online, because it is a lot. Because young people are same as us as adults, are not just on one platform. We are on multiple platforms. Mm-hmm. What we do one platform is different than another platform. How can parents keep track of all of this is very difficult. And that's why then we come into the conversation of be open and have a conversation with your children.
Yeah. Without judgment, I'm going to throw that in there in terms of, which is very difficult when parents are frightened. And I know that often that's why, that's why we react like we do when we get angry. A lot of the time it's because we're frightened about something that might have happened, could have happened, and how that makes us feel as parents. Often there's a feeling of, and I failed and people will judge me, so now I need to X, Y, Z. But certainly with the younger people under the age of, I'm going to say about 10 or 11, maybe they don't go as missing. Don't try again. That's not even English. Maybe they don't go missing as often as that cohort of adolescents that are maybe 12 to 17, 18, with this issue.
With this issue, I honestly, I think it depends on the individual. And that's the tough part. That's the difficulty, the challenge for the police, because a seven-year-old could be that they are way more advanced and intelligence than a general seven-year-old, and they're pretending to be 12 and they go missing, but they're seven. Right. And you've got the reverse of, you've got 13, 14, 15 year olds who may not behave as a 13, 14, 15 year old, but more like a 7 year old, who knows, or a 10 year old. And don't go missing. I think it's part of the environment that the child and the young persons are in that can determine if they're maybe go missing or not. Right. Yeah. There's been a case, I think it was in upper northwest of the US, where I think it was a 7 to 8 year old girl that was actually taking images, nude images of herself. She was being coerced into producing more by people online and she was making money for it.
Well, that's the TikTok generation, isn't it?
Right.
As they say. Yeah.
But she then wanted to stop, and they started to say, no, you can't stop. You've sent so many images. She went to her father and talked to her father not because of the nude images that she's been sharing, but because now she's being pressured by the online audience saying, no, you can't stop. You've just started with these images.
Yeah.
And the father had to deal with not only that his child is taking nude images, but on top of that, that there were people paying her for doing it. But she didn't run away. She went to her father. So somewhere in that relationship, father-daughter relationship, she felt comfortable enough at one point to go to her father to say, something's not right. But it wasn't the new images, it was the pressure, right?
I'm just thinking that word there, you talked about in the last episode that you did on exploitation and going missing. You talked about feeling uncomfortable rather than in this instance, she was comfortable enough to be able to talk to her dad. But actually, this is the thing that I think that, I mean, for me, this is the crux of everything, because this is what I call the uh-oh feeling. If you are in an online transaction, whatever that might be, and you've got an uh-oh feeling, that's usually an indicator that the person you're talking to, something's not quite right. And often that's the point at which children don't speak to somebody for fear of having the phone and everything removed. But that can also be a feeling that's massively associated with going missing and exploitation. And it's just, it's really important.
Yeah. Right? The young person is ashamed. They feel like they've let down the parents or their guardians. They're ashamed of what they've done. But what has transpired is that at the beginning, it probably looked, it was exciting for them, mm-hmm. right? To do something. Hey, I've got a new relationship. I've got a new person I'm talking to, and I really trust them, and I love them, and all of that. And then it suddenly turns. And as you say, it's that moment of, wait, it's no longer what I thought it was.
Yeah.
And that switch from that, from the excitement into the moment is really difficult, because you've already, how do you explain to a young person or a child that, yes, go and explore, but if you know, still be careful in exploring, because you're going to do something wrong, but don't be afraid to talk to me about it, right? Yeah. It's that balance as a parent, as a guardian, as adults, to talk to young persons and children of, yes, I want you to go and explore. I want you to have fun, but don't be afraid to talk to me if something isn't right, or you have that moment. If you think it something is going on that makes you uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And it's for me, there's something really synonymous about the way our parenting has changed as a whole cohort. That if a child was in a playground climbing a climbing frame and they fell and hurt themselves, we wouldn't stop them from going on climbing frames for the rest of their lives. And that's kind of what we're doing at the minute by taking that technology. Now, if that's a child who is being sextorted in some way, shape or form, that actually could make matters worse as far as the child is concerned. And it could actually make matters worse, which might be why I think those kind of characteristics that we give out for child sexual exploitation, look for new equipment, look for, you know, whether that be new phones, new tablets,
cameras, watches, yeah. Jewelry, clothes, any of that. And I think that's, again, that goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of what the police will ask you if your young person is missing.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of social media life do they have? What kind of platforms are they on? What do they do on these platforms? Can I get access to these platforms? Can I, you know, though, you know, that's really what's important, that we as adults have some oversight, if you like, to understand what our children are doing in the cyberspace, online, because we need to know that if something goes wrong, there's a safety net for them there, that I can go and say, yes, police, this is what's going on, help. Right.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, that feels like a really good place to finish. But to suggest that if people really want to understand this, this is kind of like an overview of what you've done on your podcast. So I will put into the, as they call them, the show notes, I'll stick in the bottom where your podcast is. You can get it on all of the iTunes, Spotify, places like that. And it's called Missing Persons Uncovered. And are you going to be doing series 3? Because I noticed that you said you got to the end of. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yes, we finished series 2 this summer, and we're now just starting to plan for season 3. We're always looking for more speakers, different topics around missing that we can educate the public on from all aspects. We've had family members on the podcast, as well as law enforcement, as well as researchers, academia, investigators from all areas and all part around the world. So we try to be as international as possible, as I said, because it is tackled in different ways in different countries and different regions. So feel free to sign up either through the YouTube channel, or through our website, missingpersonsuncovered.com. You
and
can
reach out, reach out to you if
and reach out. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me through the website, as well as Professor Karen Chaliff Green. She's got, if you go to the University of Portsmouth, there is plenty of research that has been done on missing persons, missing children, that is helpful for practitioners as much as it is for the public.
Superb. Well, thank you so much for your expertise as well as your time, Caroline.
Thank you so much, and I hope we can meet up again soon.